May it please the court, Ryan Ernst on behalf of the appellants, Rubino Bay Court Plaza, LLC, and Rubino Bay Court Pad, LLC. I'd like to introduce Alan Fellheimer. He's been admitted pro hoc vice in this case and will be doing the oral arguments today.
Thank you. Welcome to the court.
Thank you, ma'am. Good morning. Case about a shopping center, just up the road a piece. You probably ride by it all the time. On the right side of Route 13, there's a big Value Center store that now closed because Value Center has subsequently gone bankrupt, and a large pad in front of it, and it concerns that pad. And the owners of the center entered into a series of discussions with the plaintiff in this case to purchase the pad for the purpose of building on the pad, leasing it to and having built on the pad what I call a Super Y. I think they actually call it the Wawa, Super Wawa. It's a Wawa with gas. There's another Wawa down the street, but it doesn't have any gasoline. And now Wawa likes to open stores with gasoline. The problem was that there was a clause in the lease, the value lease, that says that their permission was required if you were going to build anything in the center that deviated from the original plan. But there was a clause also that said that permission would not be unreasonably withheld. In the initial agreement, it was agreed that the owners of the center would use their good faith efforts to obtain the permission of Value City. That became exceedingly difficult. Value City's demands progressed, increased, and just became outrageous. There was further discussion, and a new agreement was made, increasing the purchase price sufficiently to enable payment to Value City of what they thought it might take to get Value City to agree. The increased payment and the amount being paid to Value City clearly acknowledged to be about the same. And this was memorialized in a letter of intent that was drafted by the plaintiff's principal as a quote, to quote his deposition testimony, a cut-and-paste job. He took some of the language from his lawyer in Washington, added some other language, and put together a letter of intent. And the letter of intent provided for the new purchase price and provided, again, that the owners of the center would use good faith efforts to obtain Value City's consent.
Good faith or best efforts?
The actual language, I believe, was good faith efforts. But I think there's no argument good faith or best efforts. I think we believe that they mean the same, and we'll stipulate to either. Sir. I'm not trying to draw any distinction between them. I'm trying to be precise, but the different words are used differently throughout, and they're meant the same way, meant to be the same. There was a provision in the letter of intent for a memorialization into an agreement. Mr. McKee, the head of the seller, sent it to his lawyer in Washington, who proceeded to write an agreement that did not reflect the letter of intent. It did not say either good faith or best efforts. It said absolute requirement, created an absolute requirement, and he wrote that into the agreement. He did not, it was not what he was instructed to do. He did not tell his client. He merely took the agreement, sent it to his client to send to the seller. He didn't send it to the seller's lawyer, Doug Hirschman at Baird. He didn't send it there.
Can I interrupt?
Yes, ma'am.
Because generally we've all read all the facts and we know what the case is about. So
yes, ma'am.
Let me get to the one fact that I want to be clear on. I understand that the final version didn't have the same language as the letter of intent. And if I understand the trial court said, too bad, because the final version controls. But leaving that aside for a moment, is it correct that both parties to this agreement have acknowledged that best efforts or good faith, whichever, was the actual understanding and expectation of the parties as to what would be involved?
I cannot speak for my opponent. I can tell you only this, two pieces of evidence that we have. One, on deposition, in deposition, Mr. McKay said that that's what he had no knowledge of any change from the letter of intent, which would be the good faith, best efforts standing, best efforts standard. Second, when his counsel sent a demand and a reminder, they again, and this was after the fact, used the best efforts standard. I don't think that there is any argument that the two principals thought they were doing a best efforts.
Well, that's what I'm trying to get at. Is,
yes, ma'am.
If both sides to a dispute are agreeing that their contract was X, that's arguably pretty significant.
Yes, ma'am, I think so.
And what I'm trying to find out is whether that is of record, that both sides agree that they were working under an assumption that what was required was a best efforts or good faith effort to get the approval as opposed to an absolute requirement.
There is no evidence in this case other than the signed agreement that states otherwise, and there is tons of testimony that all the parties thought they were operating under the terms as stated in the letter of intent, best efforts, good faith. Yes, ma'am.
Including evidence from the other side.
Yes, ma'am. That Mr. McKay's own testimony, his testimony, letters from his law firm, acknowledgement by Mr. Jackson that he never discussed with his client the change he made, that he did it unilaterally without discussion, that there is no evidence, there is not one scintilla of evidence that anybody knew that change was there other than the drafter.
But this argument wasn't presented below.
Yes, sir. It was not in the form I'm doing it. No, sir. I'll admit that. But they said that the agreement was ambiguous and should have been read in light of the in light of the facts. The judge noted the sharp quote. I don't want to misquote him. I know everybody's very concerned that I state this. He said it was a sharp. I think a sharp move. Quote the judge, my reaction to this was that this was a pretty sharp move. That's a quote from the judge, from the opinion. All that was discussed. I'm in a very difficult position, but I'm going to just go right at it, Your Honor. Delaware is a small bar and takes very seriously how its lawyers behave. And criticizing a lawyer's action. First of all, this was not a Delaware lawyer. This was a District of Columbia lawyer. But the fact of the matter is the Baird firm representing my client, in whom I have nothing but the utmost respect, said it all gently, and the judge even acknowledged it, and then ignored it. He noted, acknowledged, he cited the fact that Mr. Jackson changed the intent of the party, did not write what was the intent of the party, did not write as he was instructed, did not notify anybody that he had done so, and said, quote, but my, the change document comes in from the lawyers and he, Sortini, signs it. Now, we all know we need to read documents before we sign them. Probably ought to send them to lawyers. But my reaction to this was that this was a pretty sharp move on behalf of his client, Wes Willow, and his counsel. The judge acknowledged it. Now, there's precedent in this court that where an argument presented to this court may not have been presented quite in the same fashion below is subsumed in the other arguments already put before the court below, that this court will acknowledge and allow those arguments. Furthermore, in the interest of justice. Yes, sir.
Well, I think we need to know, you know, what legal territory we're in terms of whether we can consider this argument.
Yes, sir.
I think it's... I don't think there's any dispute that no claim was made before Vice Chancellor Noble of a mutual mistake or a unilateral mistake with silence, and no claim for reformation of the contract was made.
That's not quite the case, sir. I think what is the case is that before Vice Chancellor Noble, they asked him to consider extrinsic evidence and stated that the contract was ambiguous, which is another way of trying to say pretty much the same thing. And
but, I mean, it wasn't fairly presented.
I have to admit that.
Okay, so basically, would you agree that for us to consider the claim you're making now, it has to be on the basis of the interest of justice, that is, Supreme Court ruling?
I think the interest of justice is strong, and I think Your Honor is correct in saying you can apply that. But I do think that there is precedent before this court where the argument is subsumed within the is another type of the same argument where they said that it was that the contract was ambiguous, mutual mistake or unilateral mistake, and the other standing by silently could be inferred to be part of that. But
well, you either preserve the position that you're arguing for below or you didn't, and. I thought I understood you to say that you didn't. That is, it wasn't fairly presented.
It wasn't fully presented.
It may have been presented obliquely, but
yeah,
it wasn't
obliquely.
Presented
Thank
fairly
you. I can
so
accept that.
My question to you again is, do we then, you know, do we have to decide in order to get beyond this threshold issue and on the merits of your claim that the interests of justice require it?
I believe so.
Okay.
You're using your rebuttal time, which you're welcome to do, but...
Yes, ma'am, I was answering questions.
That doesn't matter.
I would like to ask one question.
Certainly.
In order to, let's say, fairly present this claim, does it have to be fairly presented by a counterclaim for reformation? And then the reformed contract, there's no breach under the reformed contract. That's where you're headed, isn't it?
Clearly, Your Honor, that would be a better way to do it. No question that a counterclaim and reformation to the Chancellor would have made sense. But reformation as a defense could also be pled as a defense and can also be argued as a defense. Furthermore, Your Honor, one more thing. This was summary judgment. The parties did not agree for decision on a stipulated set of facts. This is a summary judgment stage. All this was raised, and if it could have been amended, the pleadings could have been amended. They clearly raised the problem. The court clearly was aware of the problem, noted the problem. In the interest of justice, if Your Honor sent this, were to remand this, would I, and if I'm handling the case, will I file a counterclaim for reformation? Absolutely. I don't think it's fatal not to, to have the fact that it had not been.
Do you want to save the rest of your time?
Yes, ma'am.
Thank you. May it please the court, Peter Walsh on behalf of the Appley West Willow Bay Court LLC. At the outset, let me correct a mistake that Mr. Fellheimer just alluded to, and that was the basis on which this case was decided. The parties most certainly did represent to the Vice Chancellor that this matter could be decided on the papers consistent with Rule 56F. So whether there was an issue or fact or not, the court was advised that, yes, in fact, he could decide this on the basis of the papers. And, in fact, Rubino below did not ever argue that there was an issue of fact. What they argued was that the plain language of the Second Amendment required only a best efforts exercise in getting the consent, not that there was ever an issue of fact.
Would you agree with opposing counsel's statement about the record here with respect to what the parties understood their agreement was, notwithstanding what the final version of the contract said?
Absolutely not, Your Honor. We could not agree to that point more. And I want to speak to that issue. Before I do so, I just wanted to point out, just to re-echo what Justice Jacobs alluded to, and that was this clearly was not in any way, shape, or form raised below. There was no reformation claim. There was no defense based upon reformation. There was no argument made in the briefing or argument that there was in any way a mutual mistake of fact. And even if there had been an assertion of a reformation claim in some proper form, Justice Berger, absolutely the record does not support reformation based upon mutual fact or a mistake of mutual fact. And the reason for that is my client and his counsel most certainly intended by this Second Amendment to obtain the performance from Rubino, which they agreed to increase the purchase price to obtain. And principally at that time in February of 2005, when they had these negotiations, there were two issues, at least two issues out there. One was subdivision approval. Rubino had contracted in the original agreement to obtain subdivision approval. It had failed to do so, and in return for an increase in the purchase price, my client said, we want you to go get a subdivision approval as the original contract requires you to. Secondly, there was the Value City consent. I don't need to go into the factual background, but it was absolutely clear to my client and his counsel that whether or not Value City actually had a right of consent under the lease agreement with Urbino, they found it desirable to get that consent because, in fact, they did not want to be in a position where they leased the property to Wawa and all of a sudden Value City shows up with an injunction. That was absolutely intended to be part of what they were paying for. And if I may refer to the record on a couple points.
Okay, but and you're welcome to do that, but what I'm going to be asking you next is the letter of intent says best efforts. It doesn't say absolute requirement. So you're going to have to explain to me how, you know, what happened between the time that that letter of intent was executed and the time the final document, final agreement was executed, where the parties had back and forth and said, well, actually, we didn't really mean what we said in our letter of intent. We have a different plan here.
Yes, Your Honor. What happened in the letter of intent, as the testimony shows, my client, Mr. McKee, after negotiations with Mr. Stortini of Rubino, put together his best effort at preparing a letter of intent, which said a couple important things. It said that it shall not be enforceable until it is reduced to a formal amendment to the agreement. It said it should not be admitted into evidence. It was in the nature of settlement discussions, and it was a layperson's effort to say, here's what we're willing to do. If you look at the agreement in itself, it has language which suggests that it was absolutely required, not simply go do your best efforts, but that, in fact, West Willow would have rights if those obligations to get subdivision approval and otherwise were not complied with. What happened after he got the letter of intent back, he turned it over to his counsel. And in the course of depositions, they attempted to ask about what the conversations were about as between my client and his lawyer, and I properly objected as attorney-client privilege. Elsewhere in the deposition, they asked Mr. McGee and Mr. Jackson, his lawyer, what did you intend by this Second Amendment? And both of them said very clearly exactly what we wanted. There's an affidavit in the record where Mr. McGee says, and I quote, in connection with the Second Amendment, I reluctantly agreed to a substantial increase in the price of the property. I did so to avoid having to enforce Rubino's performance through litigation and, more importantly, to obtain a clear and unequivocal commitment from Rubino to secure the outstanding approvals needed, including but not limited to Value City's consent. That's what my client thought, based upon privileged conversations with his lawyer, he was presenting to Mr. Stortini. If I could refer the court to the record at A15, that's Mr. McKee's deposition where he was asked about his interrogatory responses to what the Second Amendment meant, and he said exactly as pretty much what I have just quoted to you in his affidavit.
Well, then was it the conduct of the parties to proceed on the basis that the amendment actually reflected the letter of intent?
Your Honor, the letter of intent actually says in it, and I can get you a cite in the record, it actually says that it shall not be binding and that my lawyer is going to prepare a formal Second Amendment to the purchase agreement. So Mr. Stortini, when he got the Second Amendment,
certainly should have understood that this was a legal document. He had counsel, and the fact of the matter was he didn't bother to read it. He didn't send it to his counsel, and he accepted what he understood was going to be the formal binding agreement. I would also like to point the court to the Jackson testimony where Mr. Jackson, the lawyer who drafted this, was asked about it. He was not involved in the negotiations. He was presented by Mr. McGee, his client, saying, prepare a second amendment. Mr. Jackson obviously knew what had happened. Stortini and Rubino had said, we're not going to do what we're required to do under the original contract unless you pay us more. And so Mr. Jackson went back and said, well, if we're going to pay more, we're going to get what they're required to give us anyway. And it was on that basis that he prepared the Second Amendment, perhaps after going back and looking at the original agreement.
Is that what Mr. Jackson testified to?
It is, Your Honor, and I can direct your honor to A100 to 104 in the appendix, which is the testimony of Mr. Jackson. Now, there's one factual error in the court below's opinion. He suggests that Mr. Jackson, in fact, delivered the Second Amendment to Mr. Stortini. In fact, it came from my client, Mr. McKee, and that's reflected in Mr. McKee's testimony where, and in fact, Mr. Jackson, he said, I had no direct dealings with Mr. Stortini. I prepared the Second Amendment, and my client gave it to Mr. Stortini. So, Your Honor, Justice Berger, to answer your question, the testimony concerning my client and his counsel's state of mind and understanding went essentially unrebutted on the record as to what they understood they were getting in return for increasing the purchase price. And that's why a mutual understanding simply, even if it had properly been asserted below, does not fly.
Okay. What about this reference in an attorney letter that says the Second Amendment, pursuant to the terms of the Second Amendment, Rubino is specifically obligated to use its best efforts?
Your Honor, that was a letter written by counsel afterwards who I don't know whether it was in artful use, but the letter goes on to say, in essence, you have an absolute obligation to do that. And obviously, a letter after the fact, and this was in the course of trying to get performance, doesn't change the operative language of the Second Amendment. So even if Mr. Weiner, who was Mr. Jackson's partner at Sutherland, said, you know, went back and read correspondence and referred to, in a letter trying to enforce this obligation, that it's best efforts, that mistake on his part doesn't change the plain language of the agreement. It can't.
Okay, but what I'm trying to find out is what the record is on what the parties understood they had agreed to. And you're saying, well, from our side, it was clear that best efforts was no longer the operative language here. There was an absolute obligation. And yet your own attorney writes a letter seeking to enforce this agreement and uses best efforts again. That seems pretty significant as opposed to being just, well, no big deal.
Well, and you know, again, I don't think it changes. That was Mr. Weiner, the litigation partner of Mr. Jackson. But I don't. I think the remainder of the letter suggests that this is simply not a matter of best efforts. The obligation under the Second Amendment is far more unequivocal. But I certainly recognize the letters in there, and he may have. I don't know why he used the language best efforts. He was not deposed in the case.
Well, and I guess my concern is, given the record that this court is looking at, doesn't it at least create enough issues that the trial court ought to take another look at what these parties had in mind when they entered into their Second Amendment?
Well, I don't think so. On that letter, again, Mr. Weiner was not in any way involved in the negotiations regarding the Second Amendment. He did not draft the Second Amendment. Mr. Jackson drafted the Second Amendment. He was the deal lawyer. So if anybody understood what he intended, it was Mr. Jackson. And Mr. Jackson's testimony is completely unrebutted in terms of what he intended to do in that Second Amendment. In fact, his testimony was quite harsh in saying it was outrageous to him that Rubino had attempted to extract more money to do that which they were already required to do. And he went on to say, that's why I drafted this amendment, to make perfectly clear that they had to go do it. It wasn't simply an obligation, best efforts.
I understand that, you know, in your view, there's more compelling evidence that supports your client's position on this. But we're looking at a record that, at the very least, includes indications that both parties had a different understanding as to what the Second Amendment meant.
Well, I think other than Mr. Weiner's letter after the Second Amendment,
There's also the letter of intent, which...
Yes, Your Honor.
It's out there, even though it was meant to be revised into a formal agreement.
Right.
It was supposed to specify what the parties expected that formal agreement to say.
Right. And the record simply doesn't reflect the conversations, the privileged conversations between my client and his lawyer prior to submitting the Second Amendment. And so apart from Mr. Weiner's letter, there's really nothing to suggest that my client, in other words, Rubino, didn't make any record to suggest that my client, when he presented the Second Amendment to Mr. Stortini, believed it was a best efforts provision. Nothing to suggest that. And certainly nothing to suggest that the lawyer who drafted the language believed anything other than it was an absolute and unequivocal obligation.
Well, Mr. Walsh, let's assume, as Justice Berger suggested, that the record that supports your client's side of the case is not perfect. That is, there are at least these two pieces of evidence that arguably cut the other way. The question before us is, what do the interests of justice require that for purposes of Rule 8 as to whether or not we ought to entertain the claim that's being made here that was not made below?
Well, Your Honor, I think looking at the circumstances, there hasn't been a credible or I think at all persuasive argument presented as to why the court ought to consider this, given the fact that Rubino signed this agreement in February of 2005. At no time during the enforcement or attempts by my client to enforce the agreement did Rubino ever suggest that, we didn't agree to this. This is not what we understood the parties had agreed to. That argument was never made until this appeal. And so we ask ourselves, well, whose fault was it that the argument was not made? Well, Rubino, I think, of course, never asserted at any time before the litigation that there was in any way an issue here. I think the fact of the matter is, and this is in the testimony, Mr. Stortini testified that prior to the time he entered into the Second Amendment, he didn't think it was going to be a problem to get Value City's consent. And so I think the fact of the matter is he really didn't have a problem with the language of the Second Amendment. It only became a problem after he realized that Value City was going to play hardball and he wasn't able to get the consent. It's in the record. It's in the testimony. And so then the question is, why didn't his counsel argue below that there was, in fact, a mutual mistake? I think, for one, because the record would never have supported that claim. And two, they simply didn't make the argument. And so I don't – and part of the problem here, of course, is that Mr. Stortini, which the court found was a sophisticated businessman involved in many, many land deals, got the Second Amendment, didn't bother to provide it to his deal counsel, Mr. Hirschman at the Bayard firm, and signed it. And as the court recognized, that's not an excuse for not having to live up to agreements that you agree to. And that's what he agreed to. So I don't see any compelling reason that the court, in the interest of justice, ought to reconsider or now hear an argument that was never made below. Every opportunity was available to plaintiffs if they believed it was an argument that, in fact, could be sustained by the record. And again, I think that is simply not the case. And so I don't think there's any strong or compelling reasons for the court that it should now consider this argument. The last point I want to make is really, well, actually, the unilateral mistake, I think, is a variation of mutual mistake. And here, again, the record is completely deficient. After Mr. McKee presented to Mr. Stortini the Second Amendment, there's nothing, absolutely nothing in the record to suggest that my client knew or believed that Mr. Stortini was laboring under some misunderstanding about what the Second Amendment meant. It was absolutely clear on its face. If he read it, he would understand he had to go get the consents and the subdivision approval. And he never conveyed to Mr. McKee afterwards that this is just best efforts or this is what I think. So there's no unilateral mistake coupled by knowing silence. So, again, the record does not sustain that claim, even if the court were to conclude that a reformation claim should be now considered by the court below. The last point I want to make is that the court below never, ever made any finding that my client or his lawyer's conduct was in any way improper. As Your Honor is aware, agreements are reached all the time based upon memorandums of understanding and things of that nature, particularly in the representative cases. And in those cases, what we do is once parties agree to deals, they go back and they reduce them to agreements using their lawyers. And it's not uncommon that the final agreement, which is the operative agreement and what controls, is not always entirely consistent or says the same thing as the preliminary letter of intent.
Actually, was the Second Amendment sent directly to the Rubino representative as opposed through counsel?
It was. It was sent by my client. It was sent by the lawyer to my client, Mr. McKee, who in turn, I believe, faxed it to Mr. Stortini. The lawyer did not send it directly to Mr. Stortini, although the court below mistakenly indicates that in the opinion. But in the record, you will see in the testimony of Mr. Jackson, which I've cited to you at A101 to 104, Mr. Jackson makes very clear he had no part of any direct dealings with Rubino. The point I want to make is that in preparing the Second Amendment, Mr. Jackson was doing what he believed was in his client's interest. It was not in any way an attempt to pull a fast one. How was he to know that when Mr. Stortini got the document, he wasn't going to show it to Mr. Hirschman, as had been done with the original agreement? How was he going to know that Mr. Stortini would later believe that it was simply best efforts? And in the context, again, the context was we were increasing the purchase price or agreeing to pay 35% more than the original contract provided in order to get these things done. And so it should have been very clear to everybody, and I think, frankly, it was clear to everybody. This all became an issue only when Value City decided to play hardball at the end of the day. And then all of a sudden the language of the agreement became an issue.
Well, I guess let me follow up on that for a moment, because my understanding in general of the facts here is that, A, it started out nobody thought Value City would be a problem. Then Value City started getting its back up, so to speak, and saying, I want some money and I want some changes and this and that and the other thing, at which point your client puts in more money, and that additional money plus presumably something coming out of the other side was going to placate Value City, or at least that was the theory that the parties were approaching it on, and that, okay, now here's some more money, give it to Value City, get their consent. Is that a fair paraphrasing of what was going on?
Well, to some extent. I think the issue really was more the additional money was in large part prompted by the fact that this subdivision approval, which was going to require an additional easement on the property, was going to cost Rubino something. They had agreed to get it, but when, you know, it came down to getting it done, it's like, well, this is a lot of money, so let's extract more. And they did extract. But prior to then, there had been discussions about the Value City approval. And as Mr. Stortini testified, and it's in our brief, he was aware of that issue, but he didn't think it was going to be a problem. He thought he could work out a way to come to some agreement. And frankly, I think Value City did see an opportunity here and played hardball. But that clearly was a risk that Mr. Stortini assumed in signing the Second Amendment. Thank you.
Your Honors, I listened very carefully to Mr. Walsh's excellent argument. Let me tell you what he didn't tell you, what he didn't say, because he can't say. That between the letter of intent and the drafting and sending through his client of the Second Amendment, anybody spoke to either Mr. Stortini or Mr. Hirschman and said, heads up, guys, we're making a change here. I've only been in practice since 1971. I have never seen a lawyer make a change in a draft that I didn't get with either a cover letter, a cover email, or, Alan, here's a red line, you better read it. But they didn't do that. He knew Doug Hirschman was his, Mr. Jackson knew Doug Hirschman was his lawyer. He didn't say, Here's a draft. Here's the draft of the Second Amendment, and send it off to Hirschman. Whatever went on between Mr. McKee and his counsel, there's only one side. A and B can't get together and decide who are one side of the transaction and say, we're going to make a major change and not discuss it with C, or heads up, it's in there.
Well, the question is, assuming that is the fact, what legal consequence flows from it? What legal argument?
Well, the legal principle, in the interest of justice, I don't think it's proper to enforce such an agreement. Second of all, Mr. McKee himself testified at page 14 of his transcript that he was not aware of any changes, material changes made in the agreement. Now, there may have been some private conversations between him and his lawyer that nobody was allowed to ask about at deposition, and I can't help that, but nothing was discussed. But if your honors conclude that the facts are that a major change was made, it wasn't sent through counsel, it was sent to a layperson, not a lawyer, and while he may be a developer, he may have done a lot of transactions, he and the Ballard firm are to this day, you know, joined at the hip when it comes to doing agreements. And sign here, he signs. I can tell you, I know Michael Stortini, I know him very well. But nobody sent this off to Mr. Hirschman, and he believed when he signed it, it said what the letter of intent said. Nobody gave him the slightest heads up. Nobody called him, nobody negotiated, nobody discussed it.
Did the document itself give a heads up?
Your Honors, look at the document. It is legalese up one side and down the other. Could you read it? Absolutely. Could I read it? Sure. Mr. Walsh, of course. But I'm not sure it amazes me to this day that developers don't know what's in those documents, the detail that's in the boilerplate of these monstrous documents. Same thing with
Is that in the record?
Yes, sir. It's in the record. He didn't know it was there. That's in the record. And it's also in the record at page 14 of Mr. McKee's deposition, he was not aware of any changes in material conditions. And this is clearly a material change. Mr. Jackson did testify that he thought that the paying more money was outrageous. And that's a quote. And he unilaterally went ahead, and whether he discussed it with his client, we'll never know because I don't know. It's not in the record. But he did it, and he didn't send it off to Doug. He sent it back to his client. In the interest of justice, enforcing an agreement, and first of all, the duty of the court was to find the common, shared intent of the parties. And it's clearly not the common, shared intent of the parties. The evidence is clear that it's contrary evidence, and the biggest piece of evidence is you have a letter of intent. Both parties sign it, sent off to the proponent's attorney, who changes it unilaterally, admittedly doesn't send it to the other side's counsel, admittedly sends it through his client directly to the principal. There is no mention made of any changes, nothing discussed. In the interest of justice, that is not the common shared intent of the parties. That much is clear in the record. There is a lot of contrary evidence, but it's clear that there was not a single unilateral intent to have an absolute requirement. And by the way, this additional money, I think the court now understands, Your Honor, it wasn't going into Mr. Stortini's or the Rubino Company's pocket. This was being used to pay for all sorts of things. Everybody and his brother was trying to figure out how to make some money out of this. Value City, there was a requirement, some easements, there was a lot of requirements. And Value City was really being, and we've given you all that in the briefs, you know, very, very difficult and playing horrible. But the money was to be used for that. My bottom line is the court's duty was to find the clear, shared intent of the parties. And I don't think I think the evidence is clear that the shared intent of the parties was not reflected in the Second Amendment as was written.
Thank you.
Thank you.
We'll take this matter under advisement and have a brief recess.
Thank you.